Well, brother, I got a question for you this morning or this afternoon. Who was the strongest man in the Bible? Who was the strongest man in the Bible? Now, some would say Solomon. Solomon maybe was the strongest man in the Bible. If you had to live with 300 wives, you'd have to be very strong, right? So some might say that, let alone the 700 others. Others would say they'd be the very spiritual ones. Oh, Jesus Christ was the strongest man in the Bible. They would interpret that spiritually. It had to be Christ. Well, what I'm simply asking is the flat-out physical answer. Everyone would say Samson. Samson, the strongest man in the Bible. How much do we really know about the story of Samson? Probably know a lot about the story. But what we're going to do today is take a look at the story of Samson and see what spiritual modern day lessons we might be able to glean as we go over the story of Samson. Samson, legendary for his amazing strength, his power, his being used by God to free the Israelites from the Philistines. It's an inspiring story and at the same time a very sad story. A man of tremendous strength, but a man of great weakness as well. So let's take a look at the story of Samson and see what we might be able to glean from it. Now, we know when we begin the story of Samson, it's really important to step back just a little bit to give a background of the period of time in which Samson lived. We know, since we'll be turning, if you would, turn with me to Judges chapter 13. We're looking at the book of Judges. And for most Christians, as soon as we talk about the book of Judges, what comes to their mind is the cycle that Israel seemed to constantly go through, not only this time, but especially during this time. And it's that cycle of having a strong and solid leader and the people following that strong leader in worship of God. And then when that leader dies or passes from the scene, the people of God, Israel in this case, tended to slowly but surely fall away, start breaking the Sabbath, start worshiping idols, and as a result of that mistake, that walking, drifting away from God, they would then go into captivity. Now, that doesn't mean they'd be taken out of their land, but someone would come and begin to rule over them, and they would have to start paying tribute to this foreign power. And then they would repent and they'd realize they were being punished by God for their sins. They'd turn to God and then God would send a deliverer, a judge over them. This judge would be an adjudicator. He would judge right and wrong, he or she. Deborah was one of the judges. And then they would also be, in most cases, a military leader as well. And they would lead Israel to throw off the oppression, and God would bless them because they were being obedient, and they would stay faithful for the life of that judge. And after that judge died, the cycle would repeat itself again. They would slowly drift away, fall into idolatry, be taken captive, have to pay tributes, be oppressed. They repent, they return to God, God sends a judge, they deliver them. So that's the cycle in which we jump into the middle of at this point. Elon is the last judge. He was righteous. He dies. They go into a period of decline. And they are taken over this time by the Philistines. Philistines were a people to the west and to the south of where most of Israel lived, along the coast of the Mediterranean. They were seafaring people. Lots of interesting things about the Philistines. We won't take the time to go over that now. But these were the people that were now oppressing them. And so if you think of where Judah lies, and then you have the Mediterranean, you've got that west coast out there. Basically where the south, where Judah was, is where the Philistines' greatest power was. So they're bumping up against Judah in the south. Dan, at this point, the tribe of Dan did not have its own territory yet. That would come later. They were allotted territory, but they had never taken it over since the time of Joshua. So they were still kind of crunched together with the Jews, with the tribe of Judah next door. And so that's where we come into the situation. Israel here is under the thumb of the Philistines. It's one of the low points of Israel's history. They're paying massive tributes to the Philistines. Tributes are nothing more than taxes. So they're paying heavy taxes to their overlords. And it was a tough situation for them. The people of God call out, they repent, they turn to God, and so God does decide to send a deliverer to them. So let's pick up the story of Samson here in Judges 13. The first lesson that I'd like to point out that I think we can draw from this, and this is not to say these are all the lessons or even the best lessons for your situation, but they're lessons I think we can all benefit from. The first lesson is this: good people can have difficult times. Good people can have difficult times. Sometimes we as good people might have difficult times because of our own mistakes, our own faults, our own sins. But sometimes, as is the case with Samson's parents, they were experiencing difficult times because of other people's sins, because of the group they lived among who was being disobedient to God, and those curses spill over to good or righteous people. Judges chapter 13 and verse 1, again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal. They walked away from God. They participated in idolatry, broke the Sabbath. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So after Elon died, they went into this period of decline. For 40 years now, they're under the thumb of the Philistines. Now there was, verse 2, a certain man from Zorah, of the family of the Danites, so of the tribe of Dan, whose name was Manoah. And his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Eternal appeared to the woman and said to her, "Indeed, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son." So it's fascinating that here are these two righteous people in the midst of an unrighteous nation, but they're doing their part. They're being obedient to God, and they are chosen out of all the families of all of Israel. They are chosen to have the next deliverer of Israel. Quite an honor. So this angel of the Lord appears. Now, we could take an entire sermon to go through. What do you mean the angel of the Lord? It says this man appeared. It's called the angel of the Lord, or angel of the Eternal. The word angel, of course, both in the Hebrew and the Greek uses of it as it comes to English, means messenger. So it could have been an angelic messenger. But more likely than not, this was actually the one who became Jesus Christ. When God deals with human beings, he often deals directly through Jesus Christ. The one who became Christ may have been the one who actually visited with them. We'll point that out as we go along a little bit further in the story. So he gives her this message: you are barren, have not had children, but you'll conceive and bear a son. And then he says something very strange in verse 4. "Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, and not to eat anything unclean." Well, what an odd request. Well, certainly eating unclean things would have been something they always stayed away from. They didn't do that. But drinking wine or grape products, that wasn't an issue, but it is now. Now, we understand today pregnant women should not be drinking wine, at least in any amount. Maybe a little here or there couldn't be a sin, but more research seems to indicate that drinking heavily while you're pregnant is a really bad idea because it'll harm that little babe. For verse 5, "Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hands of the Philistines." So Manoah and his wife, good people, experiencing very difficult times because the sins of the people around them, are chosen to bear the next deliverer. And so she's told, don't drink wine, don't eat any grape products, and don't eat anything unclean. And when this child is born, do not ever cut his hair. Now, many are familiar with what it means, or at least the outline of what it means to be a Nazarite. But in case you're not, let's take a moment, put your 3x5 card here in Judges 13. We'll come back to this in a little while. Turn to Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6 is where the instruction is given about a Nazarite promise, referred to as a Nazarite vow. What did this mean? A Nazarite vow was a promise made by an individual who was not of the tribe of Levi. Remember that those who served in the tabernacle had to be descendants of Levi. They had to be Levites. And that special group of Levites who were called priests were not only Levites, they were a sub-family of Levi from the descendants of Aaron. So one of the children of Aaron, or descendants of Aaron, I should say Levi, was Aaron. Aaron was the priest, the Levites as a whole. So priests were both Levites and Aaronites, as you well understand. But if you chose a special vow before God that you wanted to serve God in this special way, but were not from that tribe, you could give yourself to God in a Nazarite vow, which meant, usually for a temporary period of time, it might have been a week, it might have been a month, it might have been a year, not often much longer than that, but you would give yourself to God completely to Him for His service during that temporary period of time. And that's what's described here in Numbers chapter 6 in verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or woman," most people don't understand that a Nazarite vow could be taken by a woman as well. We think of this as only men because we think of the long hair and we think of Samson, oh, it's only men. No, it's men and women. They could dedicate themselves to God. They would often be used as servants in the area of the tabernacle, doing various duties and responsibilities. "When either a man or woman can consecrate an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite to separate himself to the Lord," to sanctify themselves, in other words, give themselves completely to God's service for this period of time, "he shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. And he shall drink neither vinegar made from wine, nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh grapes or raisins." Like, what's the deal with grapes? Does God hate grapes for holy people? Well, no, it seems, at least as far as anyone seems to be able to sort out, any chance of becoming intoxicated. You see, grapes untreated do begin to ferment. When you smash them and put them in a vat, they ferment a lot quicker, but they can ferment in their own skin. So he's saying, in essence, it seems that don't drink anything that has any grape in it because there can be alcohol. I want these people to be completely and totally clear of mind. Normally, it wouldn't be a problem to drink wine or use vinegar or those things, grape juice. But in this case, I want them completely and totally in pure mind. No confusion with alcohol. Goes on to say, verse 4, "All the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin." Just stay away from it all. So there's no chance of this kind of problem coming up. So in Samson's case, he would be his entire life without alcohol, without grape juice, grape wine, etc., down the line. Don't even eat the seeds or the skins. Stay away from it completely. Be totally clear. Verse 5, "All the days of his vow, of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head." What was the point of that? He would let his hair continue to grow and grow and grow. Remember what the New Testament says about a woman's hair, her long hair? It's a symbol of her submission to God, symbol of submission to her husband. This is a symbol of this person's submission to God. Do not cut the hair. No razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. Then he shall let the locks of his head of his hair grow. Remember what Paul said about long hair on a man? He said it's a shame to them. So we don't grow long hair. This was a symbol of submission and technically a symbol of shame. Because they were vowing to God, why would you do this? Sometimes out of guilt, something I need to get closer to God for, something maybe I've done that I need to get my life straightened out, I dedicate myself to God. Maybe it was just general service, that's possible as well. But nonetheless, that's why the hair was growing. Now, was there anything special about the hair? The answer is no. What was it a symbol of? It was a symbol of obedience and submission to God. That's what the long hair was all about. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. Why? Because he would be unclean. And the purpose for which he was becoming a Nazarite was to serve God, especially around the tabernacle. So if he became unclean, he would void that ability to serve. So why would you vow if you become unclean? Verse 7, he shall not make himself unclean even for his father or his mother, for his brother or sister when they die, because the separation to God is on his head. It's a symbol of his submission to God, his special service for that period of time. All the days of his separation, he shall be holy unto the eternal. And interestingly enough, the next section says that if someone dies right next to him, so suddenly his friend next to him begins to collapse and he grabs him and lowers him to the ground, and lo and behold, the guy's dead. Oh, I'm unclean. If something like that were to happen, you go, you give a sacrifice, you shave your head, and you start all over again. No matter how much time you had paid in that vow already, let's say you'd vowed for a month and you're on day 29, day before finishing, and you get unclean by this dead body, shave the head, start all over. So you hit the reset button in that case. So God wanted them to be very careful to stay pure. And it was symbolic, of course. But that was the Nazarite vow, to especially serve God during that time. Let's go back to Judges 13 now. So Samson, the son of Manoah and his wife, was going to be a Nazarite from the time he was born for his entire life until the day he died. Let's look at that again in verse 5. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. God was beginning this cycle of delivering his people, and Samson would be the one to begin that process. Then in verse 6, so the woman came and told her husband, saying, a man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God. Very awesome. So there's something about this angel, this messenger, that was just awesome. She could tell immediately that there was something special about him. But, she said, I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. It's interesting that when the angel Gabriel came to deliver a message, he often identified himself. I am Gabriel. No identification in this case. Again, that lends itself to believing that this was the one who became Christ. Verse 7. And he said to me, behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. And you can understand why he might request this. That if you're already in the habit over the next 9 months of not eating any of this stuff and being sure you're staying away from unclean, it'll be a second nature by the time the baby arrives. You won't be over there slugging down a glass of wine with your child there, your young man, sitting not being able to drink. You set up this environment for them. So he would be a Nazarite from the womb to the day of his death. So even while you're pregnant, there'll be no wine, no grape, nothing unclean, etc. Leads us to point number two. Point number two, I think, that we can gather from this story is parents need God's help. Parents need God's help. Christian parents understand that we do not do this job by ourselves. And Manoah sets an amazing example here, as does his wife, looking to God for help in rearing their son. Verse 8, then Manoah prayed to the Eternal and said, O my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born. Teach us what we need to do. There are many a parent in the Church of God who have knelt and, in essence, asked that same prayer. Please teach us what we need to be teaching this child, because this child is yours, not mine. Help me to do my part to prepare him or her for what you have in mind for them. And that's what he was asking. God listened, verse 9, to the voice of Manoah. And the angel of God came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Verse 10, then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me. So Manoah arose, followed his wife. And when he came to the man, he said to him, are you the man who spoke to this woman? And he said, I am. Again, indication, the word am is implied in the Hebrew. It's not actually there. I am. So he may be identifying himself again as the I am, the one who became Jesus Christ. Nonetheless, verse 12, Manoah said, now let your words come to pass. Isn't it interesting that he had a very different reaction than Zechariah, for example? When Gabriel told Elizabeth, you're going to have a son, his name is going to be John, and he is going to be the one who prepares the way for Christ. I should say, when Zechariah was being told by Gabriel that, he asked, well, okay, but how will I know this is going to happen? And Gabriel first said, I'm Gabriel, do you get this? I stand before God in the throne room. Don't you understand that? You're questioning what I'm telling you? Okay, I'll give you a sign. Give me your tongue. So for 9 months, Zechariah couldn't speak because he questioned God's angel in this case. So here, Manoah, a very different reaction. Now let your words come to pass. Wow, that's stunning. Let them go. I can't wait to see that. Then he asks, what will be the boy's rule of life and his work? What is he going to be? What is he going to do? How do I help prepare him for that future? Christian parents are asking that all the time. What do I need to be doing to prepare this child for their role in your family? That's what we want to know. Manoah wanted to know that Christian parents need God's help. Children will grow up. They will. But how can we prepare them for their future in God's family? That's the question we constantly ask. If we can keep that long-range term, that long-range goal in mind, as we move forward, how much better our children will be. So he asks, what will be the boy's rule of life and his work? What rules should I have? How do I work this? What should I be doing to be able to prepare this child for his future? Verse 13. So the angel of the Eternal said to Manoah, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. In other words, just be sure. You do your part to help your wife maintain what she needs to maintain. I'll take care of the rest, in essence, is what he's saying. She, verse 14, may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe. I was serious about that. Let's do that. We want this child pure from the beginning. Continues in verse 15. Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you, and we'll prepare you a young goat. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to the Eternal. For Manoah did not know he was the angel of the Lord. He wasn't as sharp as his wife at this point, but she would get it very quickly. Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? And the angel of the Eternal said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? The implication seems to be, don't you get it? Don't you understand who I am? Name is too wonderful to even mention. Again, the implication is, was this Gabriel or Michael or some other angel with a name that would have been revealed? But this very likely was the one who became Christ himself. Same one that wrestled with Jacob. Same one that appeared to Joshua. Fascinating stories. Verse 19. So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering, offered it upon the rock of the Lord, and he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened, verse 20, as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. So you can imagine this flame starting to burn for this burnt offering. Angel of the Lord, the one who became Christ, hops into the flame and ascends up to heaven with the smoke. Fascinating. Stunning as far as they were concerned. Finally, the light bulb went on for Manoah. In verse 21, the rest of verse 20, When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. Verse 21. When the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. This is the special messenger, the messenger. Verse 22. Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." Again, that seems to be who visited them. But the wife said to him, "If the Lord had determined to kill us or desired to kill us, he would not have accepted this offering, this burnt offering and grain offering from our hands. Nor would he have shown us all these things. Nor would he have told us such things as these at this time." Remember what he said? "I'm going to have a child. We're going to keep this child pure. He's going to be a Nazarite. If he wanted us dead, he would have killed us before this." And he said, "You know, you're right. Yeah, that makes sense." Verse 24. "So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Eternal began to move upon him at Manaah Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol." So we have Samson being born. These parents cried out to God for help in raising their son, just as we cry out to God in help. For help in raising our children. They must have been very diligent in carrying out their responsibilities. They wanted to be very sure that he received the very best that they could give him. So as he grew in respect, he grew in honor, and he grew in knowledge of God. Which leads us to chapter 14. Even though parents do the very best job that they possibly can to raise their children in the way of God, Manoah and his wife learned that it was not a guarantee. Chapter 14 leads us to a third lesson. This is one primarily for our single members, our teens and young adults, those who are not yet married. Lesson number 3, don't marry just for looks. Don't marry just for looks. For looks alone. In other words, the outward appearance. One of the major mistakes in Samson's life was marrying for looks. Saw this gorgeous doll, and he was smitten. Judges chapter 14 and verse 1. Now Samson went down to Timnah. Timnah was an area kind of between the area where Israel still lived in Judah, or the Jews, I should say, and before you headed down completely into the land of the Philistines. So it's kind of a border town between Israel and the Philistines, at this time anyway. He went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. He was enamored with this woman. He was taken aback. She was gorgeous. Now, according to his view of beauty, and it's important to once in a while say that visions of beauty, what a culture considers beautiful, changes from time to time based on the culture. At this time, we're not told what she looked like, but whatever it was, Samson was smitten. He thought she was gorgeous. Now, there's no indication whatsoever that he even talked to her yet. Verse 2, "So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, 'I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, go get her for me as a wife.'" How old was Samson at this point? You know, we're not told. But it was not unusual for an older teen or a young adult in his 20s to still, of course, have marriages arranged by parents. That's the way it was done. So in this case, he could not go and ask this woman to marry him. He could not approach the woman's family. She was the property of her family. So he had to ask his parents, his father primarily, to go and make the arrangements to have this wedding take place, that I could marry her and have her as a wife. Verse 3, same story as parents in the Church of God today state. "Then his father and mother said to him, 'Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?'" How does that translate today? do not become unequally yoked together with an unbeliever. You mean you want to marry someone who's not in the faith? Why would you do that? What a mistake that is. Ask anyone who's done it. Is it completely and totally and wholesomely fulfilling? No. There's always those issues that come up that make it challenging, make it difficult. And they're pleading with their son, why would you want to do this? Sure, she's gorgeous. But trust me, they're saying that's not all there is to life. You need spiritual compatibility, not an uncircumcised Philistine. Do not marry someone who is not of the faith. It's a mistake. You'll regret it. Trust me, there will be issues. And even if there aren't quote-unquote issues, it will never be the kind of relationship you hope for. Because it cannot be when there's not spiritual compatibility. When there's not a complete totalness of mind, oneness in direction, oneness of goal, it can't be. Don't do it. Samson said to his father, Yeah. Okay, I just added that part. He said, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Dad, you don't understand. She is gorgeous. She's everything I've ever dreamed of. And that was a problem. He was dreaming. This was not reality. This was not every Saturday. You know what that Philistine woman's going to want to do? She's going to want to be at the store, at the market, at the movie theater. She's not going to be wanting to be in church for hours and chit-chatting with all those people. Oh, fellowshipping, I mean. They're not going to be wanting to do that. What's she going to be doing every Sunday? Well, she's not a real religious person, but the whole culture is. They're going to be doing other things. Setting up that Christmas tree or whatever it might be. You have to deal with all those things. Don't do it. Dad, you don't understand. She's gorgeous. Verse 4. His father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at the same time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. What did they not see? They didn't see that God would use this anyway. It doesn't say God caused this to happen or that God inspired Samson to love this Philistine woman. It simply said God was going to use it. It was of God. He'll take care of this. He will handle it. God was going to throw off the Philistine dominance of his people. And when Samson made this decision, God said, I'll use it. I'll use that. I'll make sure it happens through this, regardless. So, verse 5, Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. I'd be surprised too. And the Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him. First instance of this amazing strength and dexterity that comes to Samson through the power of the Spirit of God, I should say. The Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him. And he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. Now, anybody who's butchered a goat or anything else realizes that's no easy job. You don't just go tearing things apart. So what likely is being referred to is that when you cook a goat, and then you can tear it apart in a heartbeat. All those things that tie those sinews together and those muscles and those legs to the hips and all those things can be easily torn apart. You probably did that on Thanksgiving. You cooked your turkey right, you just bend that leg, pops right off, basically. Pretty easy. So it's saying that he grabs this lion, he rips its legs off, rips its head off, as if it was a cooked goat. This man is massive, at least in strength. Now whether his physique mirrored that, we're not told. Maybe people saw him and said, this can't be the guy. Maybe they thought, well, no wonder. Look at this guy. It's Hulk Hogan, or it's The Rock, or it's the Stone, or whatever these other guys' names are. It's Mr. Fancy Pants Wrestler, you know. I don't know what they call these guys anymore. But nonetheless, he rips this lion apart, throws it down, as if it was no big deal. Now, of course, now he's come in contact with something unclean, and in one sense, he didn't eat it, so probably that was all right. He wasn't going to the temple, so he didn't have to be clean in that sense. But verse 6, the Spirit of the Eternal came upon him. He tore the lion apart as one of them torn apart a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand, just with his bare hands. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And again, maybe because now he'd be unclean, and what would that mean? Or we're not told why he didn't tell his parents. Verse 7. Then he went down and talked with the woman, apparently for the first time. Now he talks to her. Any of you who are not yet married and you make a decision about who to marry without talking to them, I am going to slap you. No, I'm kidding. But the point is, why would you do that? Now again, in that culture, it was more of an arrangement. You often didn't know the person much until after you were married. So it's not all that unusual. But he speaks to her for the first time. Now whether she spoke Hebrew or whatever the Philistine language was, we're not told. But he speaks to her. And she pleased Samson well. So apparently, her manner of speech was similar to her manner of outward appearance. Verse 8. After some time, when he returned to get her, so apparently a few months go by, arrangements at this point were made between the families. They go back home to either collect the dowry, to get it together. A few months later, they come back for the official wedding. After some time, when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. That is really strange. Very strange. Something God must have arranged. Bees just don't go making nests in the middle of dead things, usually. I mean, they're in trees, they're in hollows, they're not in dead carcasses. Nonetheless, he took some of it in his hands and went along eating. Some people feel, well, look, the honey's inside this dead animal, unclean animal. The honey's unclean. You shouldn't be eating it. I'm not sure that that's the case necessarily. Bones are bones in one sense, but he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they also ate, but he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. I don't know if it's because it was unclean, or felt to be unclean, or ceremonially unclean, or he just didn't want them. He had this riddle in mind already. He didn't want them to know what the answer would be. Didn't want them involved with that. I don't know. But nonetheless, a stunning and unusual experience. So, what do we learn? Number 4. Samson makes this great mistake, marries someone based on looks, and it's going to lead to trouble. Lesson number 4, angry competition brings trouble. Angry competition brings trouble. Now again, sometimes this trouble, God says he'll use to spring the Israelites free from the Philistines, but you can't help but wonder if this isn't something we can learn from this. His father went down, verse 10, Judges 14:10. His father went down to the woman. In other words, made the payment, the dowry, to buy this bride. And Samson gave a feast there, for young men used to do so. So by the time this was written, it was not the custom for young men to provide the wedding feast. The custom in our culture today, for whatever reason, is that the bride's family provides the wedding feast, which I think is a terrible tradition, but it's just the way it is. Huge amounts of money are spent on weddings that, in my opinion, that's a whole other story. Is that the best way to start a new family off? I'm not sure. But nonetheless, our tradition is the bride's family pays for the big feast, not the groom's family. So in this case, Samson's family was responsible for this feast. So, verse 11, and it happened when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. So the indication is Samson's outward physique seemed to reflect the power of being able to rip a lion in half and throw it on the ground. When they saw him, they looked at him and said, whoa, we better get some reinforcements. So the 30, these were not just friendly wedding guests. These 30 were probably individuals to protect everybody else from Samson, because already a reputation had begun to be spread around. So these 30 were more like soldiers to protect people from Samson. Goes on in verse 12. Samson said to them, let me pose a riddle to you. Now stop for a second. Samson, why are you stirring this thing up? You come down here to get your wife. Now you're going to fight with these 30 guys. Now again, God's going to use this to eventually cause such trouble that the Philistines will be thrown off of their oppression of the Israelites. But this kind of combat, who's going to win in this thing? Okay, Samson, you win, and you got 30 guys who are madder than hornets at you. They win, and what are you going to do? You don't even have 30 changes of clothes. What are you going to do here? So he proposes this riddle. If you can correctly solve and explain to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. Now, maybe there's a bit of arrogance here as well. There's no way I can lose. Gamblers rarely think they can lose, and he's gambling here. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. Now, what on earth would he do with 30 outfits? It's more than a man would need. And yet, he's just, the spirit of competition is in the middle of all this. Angry competition always brings trouble. They said to him, "Pose your riddle. We'll take you on that we may hear it. 30 of us, we can figure this out. One of you can't be that hard." So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." Now there's no way any of us would ever figure that riddle out without knowing the story behind it. I mean, it's just not possible. Out of the eater came something sweet. Like, what do you? No idea. And that's what happened. These 30 guys are kicking each other, saying, "Well, we should, who knows?" For 3 days, they could not explain the riddle. Came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us." And it wasn't said so nicely. Or else, we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Everything you know, we're going to burn up. This was a threat. Very effective threat. And then they said, "Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so? You did this on purpose to steal from us, didn't you? This woman is intimidated now. Now, she may have been a woman of pure heart. That's certainly possible. But now that her family is threatened, what can she do? Verse 18, Samson's wife wept on him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me. You obviously hate me." And he said to her, "Look, I have not explained it to my own father and mother. So should I explain it to you?" I mean, don't, you're not the only one here. This is a secret. Now she had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. It's supposed to be a happy time. What does competition introduce to a situation? Always introduces difficult feelings. She is weeping the whole time. Glad I married you. Here she is bawling the whole time. Why? Well, her whole family and life is threatened. In one sense, it's not her fault. So, it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. So, verse 18, the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion?" They got the riddle. And he said to them, boy, he was mad now. "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." Now, again, there's a lot more implied in that response than probably happened. But the accusation was, this woman has given me up and been unfaithful to me. You've plowed with my heifer. Wouldn't have solved the riddle. And that certainly was true. They wouldn't have solved it without her help. But angry competition brings trouble every time. Verse 19. For the Spirit Eternal came upon him mightily, and he went down. Second event. He went down after ripping the lion apart. Now this second event, he went down to Ashkelon, another of the major cities of the Philistines, killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house, left the woman there, felt betrayed by her, went back home. And Samson's wife, verse 20, was given to his companion, who had been his best man. Now, this was not a buddy of his, but he was one that was imported for the ceremony, we might say. Not a best man the way we think of it, but the official to watch over that this was done right, that this was an official wedding. That's what the best man, quote-unquote, was at that time. So what we have here, Samson goes back home. Father assumes that he's never coming back. He's angry. He gives the wife to somebody else. Leads to lesson number 5. God uses imperfect instruments. God uses imperfect instruments. Chapter 15, in verse 1. Remember, from the day of his birth, Samson was separated to God for a holy purpose. We're not told all that Samson had done. Did he serve for a period of time in the tabernacle? Did he go back and forth to the tabernacle? Or was his service a different kind? We're simply not told about his daily life, what his responsibilities were. But nonetheless, he was growing in stature, and people noticed Samson. Noticed what was going on. Certainly, this incident of killing the 30 men, taking their things to pay off this gambling debt, would have become known. Things like this don't stay secret. So, in chapter 15, we see an issue come up in Samson's life, similar to the one in chapter 14, but quite a bit interesting. Verse 1, after a while, in the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. So we're talking several months later now. He goes to claim his wife, to begin the marriage in fact. He goes with a young goat. And he said, "Let me go into my wife, into her room." In other words, let's consummate this marriage. Let's move forward. But her father would not permit him to go in. Her father said, "I really thought you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Please take her instead. She's already married off to another man. I thought you abandoned her." In essence, that's what he's saying. Samson gets very angry again. Samson said to them, "This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them." Now he's mad at everybody. And again, you think, oh, if there was only some self-control here, maybe it wouldn't have escalated like this. Maybe God would have delivered Israel through Samson in an entirely different manner. Now, we're not told. So what does he do? Samson then went and caught 300 foxes. Most linguists of the Hebrew believe that foxes is probably jackals, not foxes as we think of foxes. Foxes are hard to catch, number one. And they're very solitary. They're all by themselves. We're talking about 300 separate trapping incidences here. Not likely. So the word is very similar. King James brought it into foxes because they didn't understand what jackals were, apparently. But the Hebrew probably indicates jackals. They tend to run in packs and are kind of stupid. And so they're easier to catch and trap, live trap, and drop in 5 or 10 in the same trap, one after another, boom, 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 down in there. So 300 is not an unreasonable number, even in that regard. So he took these foxes, or jackals, he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each of their pair of tails. Pretty brilliant. Most feel that there's probably a rope tied to one tail of one animal. And then the rope stretches 5-10 feet to the tail of another animal. And in the midpoint of that rope is tied this burning torch, because you can't burn up the animals or they can't do the job they're supposed to be doing. So you can't light their tails on fire. They're not going to burn. So you tie this firebrand, this torch, to the rope that's attached to their tails. And then you let them go. And they are scared spitless. Animals and fire do not mix. So they run as fast as they can away from the fire. And it never gets any further away. So they keep running and running and running, probably till they drop. And all the while, as they're running helter-skelter and here and there, this fire is being dragged through these dry fields of grain. So in beginning of verse 4, Samson went and caught 300 jackals. He took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, put a torch between each of their tails. Verse 5, when he had set the torches on fire, he let them go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as they continued on into the vineyards and the olive groves. And again, at this time of year, if there are shocks in the field, that means they've been cut, they've been tied, they've been stacked to dry, They're all dried. The standing grain is dry, ready to be cut. That means fall time. The grass is drying out all around. Winter rains were a long way off. Summer rains were a long way past. So this is a very dry time of year. So it burns up all these crops, their future, their next year of eating. And the Philistines said, "Who has done this?" And they answered, Samson didn't do this by himself. He had a whole crew of people probably trapping these things who were of like mind with him, thought the Philistines should be punished, should be gotten rid of. So Philistines pressed somebody, "Who has done this?" They answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. It's the Timnite's fault." So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Vicious people. And again, when this spirit of revenge starts in a cycle, it never seems to stop until somebody is completely eliminated. So they simply, whether they pulled them out of the house and put them on a stake and burned them alive, or whether they just strapped them in the house or set the house on fire, we're simply not told. But it was gruesome. Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you. And after that, I'll cease." But we know revenge never stops. So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. The phrase hip and thigh just means nonstop, total slaughter. Attacked them hip and thigh, tip to top, we might say, tip to toe or something like that, with a great slaughter. Then went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Etam, a cave down in that area. He fled for his life because he knew at this point it was on the edge. So, verse 9, the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi. The men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us? We had this arrangement. We pay taxes, you leave us alone. What's the deal? Why have you brought your armies here?" They answered, "We have come up to arrest Samson, to do him as he has done to us." That cycle of revenge continues growing and growing and growing. Verse 11, then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the cave, the rock of Edom, and said to Samson, "Do you know that the Philistines rule over us? Don't you get it? We pay them some taxes. They leave us alone. They're too powerful for us. Don't stir them up. What is this that you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, so I've done to them. Tit for tat, I'm doing it. They did it to me." But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." They didn't get it. They didn't understand. They wanted to preserve the status quo. There's an old Jewish saying that says, "The devil I know is better than the devil I don't know." Point being, as bad as this guy is, we get rid of him and somebody else, he could be a lot worse. So I can deal with this. And that was their attitude, that that's bad, but we don't know what's coming. If this gets thrown off, it could be worse. So they're going to turn Samson over, and they do. Then Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." So they spoke to him, saying, "No, but we will surely deliver you up securely and deliver you, tie you securely and deliver you into their hand. But we will surely not kill you." And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. So they're going to turn him over to the Philistines. And when he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. They're screaming, they're yelling toward him. They're so happy that they've got now the enemy of the Philistines. Then the Spirit of the Eternal, at least the third, if not fourth time, the Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him. And the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that's burned with fire, snapped right off. His bonds broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. And you think about that, you think that's kind of odd too. Well, is this dead donkeys laying all over the place? They just pick up this donkey skull and start killing people? Now, again, it's interesting that it's a freshly killed donkey. Because if it was a dried up old jawbone, it couldn't do anything. It'd smash. It'd crack to pieces as you used it against people's heads. So that's apparently what he did. He just started smashing heads. Found the fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. Now, for those who are statisticians, 1,000, you know how hard it is to kill 1,000 people? It's got to be incredibly difficult. So here he is swinging this jawbone, just bashing in heads right and left, one after another. He didn't just stand there and wait for them to come. You pile up 20 people, you can't see anymore. 1,000 people! For those younger in the audience, what I think of is Yoda and his lightsaber. Remember in the movie, he's bouncing all over the place. He's jumping off the ceiling and doing flips and spins and things like that. That had to be what Samson did. Okay, everybody older than 40 is going, like, what are you talking about? Everyone who's seen the movies, yeah, probably. So this guy must have been all over the field, slaying people. They couldn't lay a hand on him. He didn't have a scratch by the time it's done. Killed 1,000 people with a hand tool. This jawbone of a donkey. Stunning victory. God gave him that power. Why? He was going to free them. He was using Samson, an imperfect, sometimes angry, many times lustful individual, but he was using him nonetheless. Verse 15, he found this fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand, took it, killed 1,000 men with it. Verse 16, then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've slain 1,000 men. That's a much better rhyme in the Hebrew than it turns out in English. And so it was, when he had finished speaking, that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called that place Ramath-Lehi. And it's probably just almost fused to his hand. So finally just had to throw it down. Then he became very thirsty, I suppose so. He cried out to the Eternal and said, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? I'm about to die. So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi, and water came out. Miracle, just like in the time of Moses. And he drank, and his spirit returned. He was refreshed, revived, as it says here. Therefore, he called the name En-Hakkor, which is in Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel in 20 years in the days of the Philistines. So apparently from this time forward, when the Jews were going to turn him over to the Philistines, they now recognize him as the judge over Israel, the one who will deliver them. They finally got the picture that the Philistines were not invincible, that God had sent a deliverer to take care of them. God uses imperfect instruments. As we think about that point for a minute, it should go without saying, do not expect God's servants to be perfect at any level. Oh, they are good men, and they strive hard to do as God commands. But they're not perfect. We should not expect that. God uses imperfect instruments. Lesson number 6, we must remain steadfast and diligent. During this 20 years, something happened to Samson. We're not told what. We're not told anything about the intervening 20 years from the time of him killing 1,000 of the Philistines and what we read in chapter 16. But something happened. What happened? Samson did not remain steadfast. Maybe he never was. We're not told. But he did not remain steadfast if he had been. He did not remain diligent to keep his human nature under control, to fight that nature within him. We'd already seen that he had apparently this problem with lust. He went down, he saw this woman, he wanted her for marriage. We see it getting worse 20 years later. So now we have the last few months of Samson's life being described. We're told that he judged Israel. We assume that people looked to him for wisdom, for discernment, for judging right and wrong in difficult situations, and he probably did that in a reasonable manner. But we're not told about his private life because we find that his relationship with God must have crumbled and virtually disappeared. Because the behavior we find in chapter 16 for a man of God is unconscionable. just not right at all. Now you might say, well, you don't have any scriptures for that. I mean, that's true. Well, we'll see that as we get into chapter 16. But what I'd like to do is just go on to point number 7. And that is, heed God's warnings. Samson had been drifting from God in that intervening 20 years. How do we know? Because we come to chapter 16 and he sins without any pangs of conscience whatsoever. So we know something had to desperately go wrong or continue in a wrong direction for these 20 years. Lesson number 7, heed God's warning. I don't know that God ever punishes his people without warning first. So we might say in our personal lives, if we see a warning, we had better take heed. I think God does that for us as well. He loves us so much, he allows us warnings before tragedy really comes. Judges 16 and verse 1, Samson went to Gaza, and he saw a harlot there and went in to her. So in the intervening 20 years, any morality that had been left was now gone. And it was now perfectly fine in his mind to go visit a harlot. So whatever was the problem 20 or more years before, when he went down to Timnah and saw a good-looking woman and wanted her a wife, now it didn't matter if she was a wife or not. He just wanted her and went into her. God, I believe, warned Samson here. Verse 2, when the Gazites were told, Samson has come here. Now, in the intervening 20 years, had Samson led campaigns against the Philistines? Very likely. Had they been pushing back the Philistines and their rule? Probably. So Samson was very famous. It wasn't, oh, this guy 20 years ago killed 1,000 people. This guy is always the problem. He's always killing our people. He's always pushing us back. Now he's here in our city. Now again, maybe again a bit of bravado, a bit of arrogance. He felt he could go into one of their five, Gaza was one of the five Philistine capitals. He felt he could go there without any problem. Samson has come here. They surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, in the morning when it's daylight, we will kill him. I think that was a warning. Samson was completely surrounded. Samson lay low, verse 3, till midnight, arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city. God's Spirit again comes on him in great power. He simply rips up the posts that held the gate. Now again, this is not a 30-foot gate. More likely than not, this was one of the horse gates of the city. So 5-6 foot tall, enough for a person on a horse to ride through if you ducked down and you wouldn't hit your head. But nonetheless, he rips the posts out of the ground with the hinges, with the doors, throws it on his back and carries it away. Amazing miracle. God still blessed him in spite of his being there with a prostitute. Now, some would say, well, I guess that's not a problem then. No. God warned Samson. This was his final warning. Were there other warnings before this? Maybe. This was his last warning. Numbers says, be sure your sins will find you out. Samson would learn that. He laid low till midnight. He arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Some say this was all the way to the hill that is in front of Hebron. If that's the case, it was over 20 miles that he carried these gates overnight. Maybe that's the case. Others say, oh, it's just the hill outside of Gaza that faces toward Hebron. And maybe that's the case. Nonetheless, it was a stunning miracle of incredible strength. But it was Samson's final warning. Verse 4. And it happened afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The most common words following the word Samson is what? And Delilah. Delilah was a treacherous woman. Maybe she didn't start out that way, but money talks, at least for many people. and it certainly talked to her. You are well familiar with the story from here on out. Now, many would say, based on previous experience in the chapter, that in all likelihood, Delilah was also a prostitute. Maybe that's the case, maybe not. The scripture doesn't tell us specifically, but it's not an unreasonable supposition, given Samson's track record up to this point. Verse 5, and the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, you see, they didn't entice her by saying, we're going to kill you, we're going to burn you to a crisp if you don't do what we say. They came with a payment, which would have been similar to her profession, possibly. Entice him and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. In our terms, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. 11 of these individuals. Every one of us. Maybe it was the 5 lords of the Philistines. That's possible. So we're talking about 1,100 pieces of silver, huge amounts of money. So Delilah said to Samson, now again, maybe it wasn't immediate, but it seems to give the indication there was no conscience here whatsoever. We're talking big money. And this guy's a hulk, but we're talking money here. We're talking about security for the rest of my life. So she betrayed him. Please, verse 6, tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound to afflict you. Samson said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings not yet dried, then I'll become weak and be like any other man. So the lords of the Philistines did so. They brought those yet not yet dried. She bound him with them. Now when the men were lying in wait, staying with her in the room, she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he broke the bowstrings as a strand of yarn breaks when it touches fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Delilah said to him, now I assume some time went by, maybe months in between these, we're not told. If it was only a very short time, Samson is stupider than we think. Like, it doesn't become obvious after a day or two? No, this is months later, probably. Delilah says to Samson, look, you've mocked me, you've told me lies. Now please tell me with what you may be bound. Now pause for just a moment. Why do we think she was probably a prostitute? Does it ever talk about marriage here? No. Nope. So he was shacking up with this woman. No other conclusion. You've mocked me. Tell me with what you may be bound. So he said to her, if they bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, then I'll become weak and like any other man. Therefore Delilah took new ropes, bound him with them, and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. Now you have to ask, how did she tie this guy up? Was this voluntary? It was a deal. There was something weird going on. I don't know. But it wasn't godly. We know that. Was he so drunk or asleep that he allowed himself to be tied up? What's going on? We're not told. Something was very, very wrong. Delilah says to Samson in verse 13, of course he breaks them off like thread, it says. Delilah says to Samson in verse 13, until now, you've mocked me and told me lies. Tell me with what you may be bound. And he gives a third story lie. So he lies to her 3 times. Again, something's dramatically wrong with his moral compass. Now he's lying to her. He might be saying to himself, well, no big deal. Can't tell her the truth. If you weave, I can't believe that he's not laughing by this time. He said, if you weave 7 locks of my head into the web of the loom. So you take the loom and you make this warp and woof and you put it together and I'll be stuck in this womb, the loom, and I won't be able to get out. Come on. He's got to be snickering at this point. She wove it tightly, in verse 14, with the batten of the loom, and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. He awoke from his sleep, pulled out the batten and the web from the loom, just ripped the whole thing apart as he got up. Then, again, time goes by. She says to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? Again, his moral compass was broken. No business telling this woman he loved her. He was sleeping with her. How can you tell me you love me when your heart's not with me. You've mocked me these three times and have not told me where your great strength lies. And it came to pass when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him. You have to ask, what was he doing there? It's in the valley of Sorek. This is a Philistine area. What's he doing there? Why is he not doing his job? What's going on? He has lost his moral compass. If he ever had it, and we're not even told that. Verse 16. She pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death. Ladies, it is possible to vex your husband to death. It is possible. Constant, over and over. Now, sometimes husbands, we almost deserve that because of our stupidity, but that's a different story. Both have to be working on our parts. Verse 17. He told her all his heart. Finally, she could tell this was the truth. And he said to her, he must have had that look deep into her eyes, no razor has ever come upon my head. For I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I'm shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. Did Samson have magic hair? The answer is no. Hair had little to do with it, except that it was a symbol of his obedience to God, his submission to God. When he was no longer in submission to God, the hair didn't matter. So it was taken off to show that he had left his submission to God. He had walked away from God. Verse 18, when Delilah saw that he told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up once more, for he has told me all his heart. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her, brought her the money in their hand, and I'll bet you a dime to a dollar she checked before she told him anything. My guess. Verse 19, she lulled him to sleep on her knees. Now again, either Samson was an extremely deep sleeper, which I don't think is the case, or there were other things involved. Probably sex and alcohol. That's my guess. He wasn't supposed to be drinking it, but how do you get into this deep a sleep? How do you do it? I mean, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm reading more into that than's there. But she lulled him to sleep on her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. So apparently he braided his hair into seven locks. Now what's interesting to me is she didn't cut it off. Because what if he woke up? She'd be pretending that she was asleep too. And she didn't know anything about this. That's my guess. I don't know. Maybe not. That's my guess. Then she began to torment him and his strength left him. And she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he awoke from his sleep and said, I will go out as before, as other times, shake myself free. But he did not know that the Eternal had departed from him until it was too late. And degradation happens in stages. It's a drain. It's not all at once. All of a sudden we reach for the strength and it's not there. He did not heed the warnings. And it was now over. Verse 21, the Philistines took him, put out his eyes, and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters. He became a grinder in the prison. Turn this millstone to grind their grain. However, we lead to point number 8. God is very forgiving. God is very forgiving. Remember what we said would happen if a Nazarite became unclean during his or her vow, what would they have to do? They would shave their head and start all over again. This was Samson's start over, redo, do over. Verse 22, however, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven. What he went through was such a shock to his spiritual system, he deeply repented and turned back to God. He must have realized that he had gone so far from God to allow this to happen. The supposition is he began to change, to turn to God, to repent. Not a full repentance like we might understand, but enough of a repentance to turn back to God. Verse 23. Now the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god, to rejoice. And they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands Samson our enemy." When the people saw him, they praised their god. For they said, "Was it their God who'd gotten this Samson?" No, God turned him over. God turned him over because of his disobedience. When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land, and the one who multiplied our dead." It was more than just the 1,000. It's more than just the 30. It was 20 years worth of beating back the Philistines. Verse 25. So it happened, when their hearts were merry, that they said, "Call for Samson, that he may perform for us." So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them. We're not told what that performance was, but they made fun of him. They mocked him, no doubt. And they stationed him between the pillars. Then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, "Let me feel the pillars which support the temple, so that I can lean on them." Excavations have actually found temples with two main pillars, not 6 feet from each other, that support the entire structure. That's the kind of structure they were in. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof, watching while Samson performed. So here they are at this ceremony for their pagan god. They bring Samson out. All the dignitaries, all the government leaders are going to be here. Then Samson called to the Eternal. First time we hear of Samson actually praying. Maybe it was the first time. I doubt it was, but it's the only one recorded. He calls to the Eternal, saying, "O Eternal God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me just this once, O God, that I may with this one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes." Now, a better statement, no doubt, would have been, "That I can take revenge for you, that I can clear your name." Now, maybe that was in his heart. He just didn't say it. We're not told. But nonetheless, verse 29, Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple. He braced himself against them, one on his right, the other on his left. Then Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at this death were more than he killed in his life. Thousands died there. And you cut off the head, in essence, the leadership of the oppressor nation, and they no longer have the strength to oppress. Israel began to be free from that point forward. His brothers, all his father's household, came down, took him, brought him up, buried him between Zerah and Eshtaol in the temple of his father Manoah. He had judged Israel for 20 years. God is very forgiving, very merciful. In spite of the mistakes and the troubles and the lack of character, he still used Samson this last time to free Israel from the Philistines. Quite a striking example. The only other time from this moment forward that Samson is ever mentioned in the Bible again is Hebrews 11, verse 32. Hebrews 11, verse 32, where he is listed in the hall of fame of faith. Paul apparently wrote Hebrews. He said, "What more shall I say? For the time would fail me," when talking about faith, "to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah among David and Samuel and the other prophets." So Samson is listed as one of the great men of faith, an example for us. Brethren, when we fall short, we repent, we turn to God, we let that spiritual hair grow again, we rededicate ourselves to God, and we move forward. God is very forgiving, and He will forgive. If our repentance is true and honest, God is very forgiving. So Samson, story is a unique one. Story of great strength, and yet of great weakness, returning to great strength. Inspiring story, yet sad story. Let us benefit from the life of Samson and apply the lessons of great strength therein.